Welcome to Money in Mission here on Holy Family Radio, AM 720, where every week we talk about wealth management and investment planning built on a foundation of biblical principles and biblical wisdom. I'm James Good.
And I am Eric Terrio.
And it's so good to be here with you today. Do you ever wonder how your money and the stuff you own are actually helping you to live out what you really, really feel called to in your heart? You know, there's so much peace of mind that comes when you can sense that your money is aligned with your values and your convictions, as well as your financial goals. And there's really, really peace of mind that comes when you know that your financial goals are in sync with your values and convictions. There's just so much potential for anxiety when you feel that your money's not in alignment with your values and convictions.
That's right, and it's easier said than done. There's so much financial information coming at us every minute of every day. It can actually be overwhelming. Terminology, ideas and philosophies, varying competing principles, and of course, financial products and services.
Yeah, isn't there some way it could be easy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that would just be nice to take all that stuff and just make it easy. Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. Well, you know, keeping all of that information straight can be downright confusing and possibly even scary.
That's right.
Right, yeah. When you're confused or just not sure which direction to turn, you don't make good decisions. And that can keep you from being all that God wants you to be. And it can hurt you pretty badly as well. Each week here on the show, we talk about some current financial events so that you'll have a better understanding of what some of the terminology and events actually mean. And we can't tell you what your mission is, but we can help you work at understanding the tools that you have to work with, what some of the terminology and some of the ideas actually mean.
That's right. And part of the way through the show, we'll get to our weekly puzzler.
Don't forget about the weekly puzzle.
That's right.
That's right.
Our weekly puzzler is a brain teaser, a puzzle that we'll share with you.
And we hope it'll be an interesting puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting to us anyway. And
it's interesting looking for them and figuring out which one to put on here. There's a lot of good ones.
That's right. And some not so good too, right?
Yeah, we're trying to filter them out.
Yeah, my family likes to say, James, don't say that one. Please don't say that on the air. But, you know, as we record this show, coming into the first segment here, we really wanted to highlight a couple of things that were happening this week.
Yeah, and as we record this show, core inflation is reported to be easing, which means that professional investors think there's an increased possibility the Fed will cut rates this year at some point.
Yeah, I just love that term, core inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, there's actually three definitions of inflation now.
Three.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, to me, it always just means prices went up.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the
easy
one.
Too many dollars chasing too few goods.
That's right. Yeah. And the more money you have chasing stuff, if there's less of it or even the same amount, then it just causes prices to go up. But headline inflation, as they call it, it involves everything you can think of. It involves the food you eat, the gas you put in your car, mm-hmm. The stuff you buy for your home.
And we went over some of them broad categories
the
other week.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We did the other week. So why are we hitting it again? Well, because it's still out there.
That's right.
It's still happening.
Front and center.
That's right. So there's headline and then core, which takes out food and energy. And then there's actually this new term called super core. Yeah. Which takes out housing costs too. So it's like, what do you have left? Well, the cost of a cup of coffee, I guess, or just services in general. I saw this article here in the Wall Street Journal the other day. It said inflation eased in May,
mm-hmm.
Improving the odds of a 2024 rate cut. But You know what was interesting to me? Do you remember the Fed's target for inflation is
2%?
Yeah, 2%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have no idea where anybody came up with 2%. There's a story behind that, but I didn't get those notes ready for the show today. But the target is 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so this article really goes on to say that the consumer price index is up 3.4% from a year ago.
Hmm.
And that's like somehow newsworthy. 3.4 is nowhere close to 2.
No.
Right.
That's almost double 2.
That's almost double 2.
Yeah.
But the 3.4, at least, you know, wow, the way I count the numbers, I think that is a long way away from the 2% target.
And I guess that's why we haven't seen the Fed making any moves.
That's kind of the feeling, yeah. I mean, the Fed keeps saying how they're data-driven and they want to see the right data coming in, letting us know that we're actually getting to where the target actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if the data keeps coming in, this is data, right? 3.4%. And this is core. It said after they took out the cost of food and energy, which tend to be, quote, more volatile.
And I also seen that the Fed, they released economic projections for the next few years, indicating a slightly higher expectation for core inflation that you're talking about by the end of the year.
That's right.
And they also projected a modest growth of 2.1% for the economy this year.
Wow. So if your economy grows by 2.1,
mm-hmm,
and you inflate by 3.5.
I think that's 1.3 still remaining.
That's, yeah. Okay, well, I guess I kind of do the math on that and say I think the economy shrank,
mm-hmm,
a little bit,
right?
Because if you had to inflate by 3.5 and you only grew at 2.1, well then that's shrinking. But still, the market seemed to be very happy on that news. So so the market jumped a bit earlier this week, but it was interesting that Treasury yields. That's just the yield that people are getting when they buy a Treasury bond or a Treasury bill or a Treasury note.
Mm-hmm.
Treasury yields were kind of on track to have declines, which meant that the price of bonds was going up, but then the yield on those bonds was coming down.
Hmm.
And we've talked already, you know, here on the show about the yield curve.
Mm-hmm. On episode 1, we talked about the inverted yield curve.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it's, you know, I get bank profits. Banks make money by borrowing.
That's
at short-term rates,
mm-hmm,
and they lend at long-term rates. So when the curve inverts, this model becomes less profitable for them, potentially leading to tighter lending standards and less economic activity.
Tighter, yeah, and lending standards are already tight.
They are.
Right? I mean, stuff people are, hoops people are having to jump through just to,
even, you know, the big ticket items, the houses, the cars, personal lines. These rates are out of control.
That's exactly right.
And but people are getting themselves into bad pickles by getting themselves in debt with those rates.
That's exactly right. Yeah, but I'm looking here at a chart of the yield curve, and it does look, you know, like near-term rates are certainly higher, like 3-month rates are higher than 6-month rates, and six-month rates are higher than 9-month rates. So the rate is going down, you know, as you go further out. We said this a month ago, and it still is the same, right? Except when you get all the way out to like 30-year bonds,
mm-hmm,
it seems like the rates jump up a little bit there again.
Inverts right at the end.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But 30 years would be a really long time to put your money on deposit somewhere just to get
a tiny character you like to talk about, Rip Van Winkle?
Oh, how long did he sleep?
Yeah.
That's how I fell asleep and I woke up 30 years from now so I could get a little bit more,
uh-huh,
interest. Yeah. Usually, you know, the interesting thing is when the yield curve is inverted like that, that's usually bad for stocks.
How so?
Right. Well, because, you know, if you picture all of these different buckets, like put all stocks in one bucket and all bonds in another bucket,
mm-hmm,
and all real estate in a bucket and commodities and precious metals and so on. So you have these different buckets, and those buckets are called asset classes, and just different the same type of investment all grouped together in a group.
Right.
And so let's say you have someone who is an income-oriented investor, and maybe they historically they've purchased like utility stocks or real estate stocks or something that generates a dividend that they can take dividends. Mm-hmm. There's risk involved in stocks. Stocks go up and down, so they've bought these stocks for income, and then lo and behold, the yield curve inverts.
And it reduces the attractiveness of
it. It reduces the attractiveness of the income producing stocks, mm-hmm. because now they can get either the same or maybe a higher rate of interest, and it feels like there's really not very much risk at all.
Lowering the demand of those stocks, lowering the cost price of those stocks.
That's right, yeah. And if supply and demand really kicks in, then what you have is less demand for those stocks, and if that continues to weaken, then at some point it becomes a challenge where the stock market starts to fall off, and that impacts potentially people's investments. So, but here on the show, we don't predict the future. The yield curve now has been inverted for over a year and a half.
Yeah, it's just a reality that we're in.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so historically, that's, been kind of a flag or a canary in a coal mine, if you will. But we'll see. Will it work the same way this time, or will we kind of get through this and not experience a significant correction in the market? We'll see. Again, we don't like to make predictions, but we do like to stay current and help you, our listeners, to be aware of what's happening out there in the world.
That's right.
So, so the whole world does seem to be watching the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, just in a reminder of how much influence this one body of policymakers actually has. When somebody stands up and says, "Hey, we're raising interest rates," and all of a sudden the world moves, that's a lot of influence right there.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we're all out of time for this section. We will be back. Well, we will talk about another tool, mutual funds, after this break. You are listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio. WHYF AM 720.
Welcome back to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, where we're talking about wealth management and investment planning built on a foundation of biblical principles and wisdom. I'm James.
And I'm Eric. And today we are talking about a financial tool a lot of people use in their portfolios. This request came from one of our listeners. The financial tool we're talking about today is mutual funds.
Yeah, I was going to say, and over there is Joe Murphy.
Oh, there's
right? Because,
Joe Murphy.
That's right, because it's a wave hi, Joe, and so everybody can see you on the radio, right? We usually say hi to Joe Nebesinski, but today is Joe Murphy, so it's so good to have you here. Sorry, I was really off script there. I was off track, but yes, we are talking about mutual funds. Tools are such wonderful things.
Yeah, unless you happen to be using the wrong tools for the job, right?
Yes. That would be a horror story, right? I don't know if this ever happened to you, but let's say you have a box full of screwdrivers and you're trying to back a screw out, and maybe it's a Phillips head screwdriver, and lo and behold, it's the wrong size.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you need a screwdriver to take the screw out, or put it in, whatever. But I do this all the time. I look at it and I think, it's got that little cross shape like a Phillips head does, and then you start turning and it slips, and pretty soon
you might strip it.
That's mm-hmm. right. Do you ever use a flathead screwdriver to try to turn a Phillips head screw?
I have before.
Yeah. It, Didn't want to ask you to say that in front of people. But
well, it's normally when I'm up on a ladder and I don't want to go down and get the Phillips. So.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, you know, you do things. But lo and behold, I mean, a flathead screwdriver just isn't designed to do that. It's the wrong tool for the job. What's that other kind of screwdriver? It's like a hex.
Allen keys, Allen screwdrivers.
Yeah,
they got Allen heads on them.
Same thing. Those things strip so fast, but there you are, and pretty soon the screw, it strips out, and pretty soon it's worthless, right? If it's already in a piece of wood or something, you can't take it out because you just ruined the screw, and you have
to cut it, drill down, and
just the enormously frustrating thing. So tools, the right tools at the right time are just so important.
And there's also the old adage, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
That is a fact.
It means that if, you know, your only tool or skill is limited, you tend to see every problem as something to be solved using that tool or that skill, even if it's not the most appropriate solution. And this can lead to ineffective or even harmful approaches.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter the size of the hammer.
No.
Right. No. If it's a little hammer, then it's a little problem, but it's a little nail.
You're going to start bashing everything up.
That's right. This is terrible, right? I mean, we should be talking about something more fun. But, you know, I have a story. Financial products and services are the same kinds of tools, really, and just they're financial tools. And we've said before that, you know, when money goes out from your checkbook, or when you put money on deposit, or you make an investment somewhere, that it has an impact. Something happens. And every time we do that, we hope for a certain outcome from the financial products that we have in our portfolios. You know, I guess it was 25 years ago or so, I was working in a particular office, and this woman came in, and she was very, she was distraught, right? I mean, she was very careful always with her money, and she was careful how she spent things. But, you know, she said, I just don't quite know what's happening, because I've always had enough, and I've always been very frugal and experienced good stewardship and everything. But it just seems like as the years go by, my money just doesn't seem to reach as far as it used to. And so in talking with her, you know, I learned that all of her money was really in low interest bearing kinds of vehicles, and the cost of living just kept going up and going up, and pretty soon her money just didn't stretch as far as it used to, and she was just, you know, she was using not all the right tools, right? There could have been other tools in the toolbox.
And if we only have a limited understanding of financial tools and strategies, we might try to apply those same solutions to every financial problem.
Even
when they're not suitable.
That's exactly right. So, well, we're talking about mutual funds.
Mm-hmm. So what is a mutual fund? Let's start there.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. And really from the very outset, I suppose we should say that mutual funds do involve a level of risk.
Yes, they do.
I mean, everything you do involves a level of risk. It would so be nice if we lived in a world that didn't have any risk in it, but we don't. So we have to understand the risks that we have, and we have to understand the tools in our toolbox. So what is a mutual fund? Well, a mutual fund is picture a mutual fund as being like a bucket, mm-hmm. and many, many investors will send money to that bucket. So they'll send money to the mutual fund. And some people send a lot, some people send a little. But what happens is when the money gets there, then there's either a manager or a team of managers that take that money and they invest the money in a number of different things according to a business plan.
Right.
And we'll talk more about that business plan a bit later. So now the mutual fund has the investors' money, and then the managers of the fund, they will buy typically a portfolio of stocks. Sometimes mm-hmm. they'll buy a portfolio of bonds or other vehicles. Like some mutual funds buy real estate, and sometimes mutual funds buy precious metals and commodities and options and futures and whatever it is that they've described as their business plan. So the mutual fund invests that money in a portfolio, and an investor receives a share or number of shares of the mutual fund, and then the value of those shares fluctuates up and down as the value of the portfolio fluctuates up and down, and that's where investment risk is included in that whole proposition.
And they don't actually own a share of that stock, correct?
Correct. That's right.
That is inside the mutual fund.
That's right. So if somebody is invested in the Wildlife of Texas Mutual Fund, they would have shares of the Wildlife of Texas Mutual Fund, but the mutual fund would own the stocks and the bonds.
But not
and
the actual holdings.
But not the actual holdings. That's right.
I like the analogy of thinking of a mutual fund as a pizza.
Oh.
Yeah, you could buy all the ingredients, the stocks and bonds, and make your own pizza, but that takes time and skill. Or you could just buy a slice, like a mutual fund share that you're saying, from a pizzeria, a fund company that has already done that work for you.
Right. Is there any chance that a mutual fund could be like a peanut butter cup?
It can be.
It can.
Most certainly can be.
We try to work that theme in every week. That's right. Yeah. But no, I mean, as a pizza slice is a great analogy. But as a tool, then, people use those mutual funds to try to achieve some of their financial goals.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a long list of things that people do. We don't have time to read the whole list, but certainly, anyone that is accumulating wealth for some point in the future, maybe it's retirement, mm-hmm. or maybe they are, trying to build up wealth that eventually they can pass on to their children as an inheritance. So they use those mutual funds to accumulate wealth. Then, used properly, sometimes mutual funds can distribute wealth.
Yes.
When people get into retirement, they can potentially take income from their mutual funds, or sometimes people send money from their mutual funds to their favorite charities, and that becomes part of a planned charitable giving program. And
it could also be used for education planning.
Education planning.
There's certain tax advantage accounts.
That's
right. You can have mutual funds mm-hmm. for education planning.
That's right. And so they're investing for, to send someone to school,
mm-hmm.
right, for qualified education expenses. That's right. And sometimes you'll see mutual funds actually be collateral for loans. And that's
an interesting one.
Yeah. And clearly there's rules. We just talked a few minutes ago about the hoops that people are jumping through to get loans mm-hmm. these days. But certainly lending institutions would have very specific rules if they were going to be using a mutual fund as collateral for a loan. So a mutual fund is a tool, and there are many, many purposes that people have and things they're hoping for when they invest in a mutual fund. And there is just a laundry list of mutual funds in the market today.
Yeah, thousands, correct?
Like 24,000.
Yeah, almost double the amount of stocks, correct?
And we just, we pulled that number 24,000 from the Morningstar Investment Research database, and we just kind of go onto the database and we look to see how many mutual funds are listed, and it's not quite 24,000, but it's an enormous number. So this becomes a very interesting challenge then, because having a tool available to you to get something done that you're trying to get accomplished is huge, and you want to make sure that you have the right tools in your toolbox.
That's right.
Yeah. And I do see that we're pushing up against time here. We should
probably get to our puzzle.
Yeah. Let's do the puzzle section. That's right. Let's do last week's puzzle. And then maybe when we can come back, we can get this week's puzzle.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds good.
Do you remember what the puzzle was last week?
I do. The puzzle from last week was, if you live 8 miles from your local grocery store, and after walking 1 hour, you travel 50% of the way to the store.
Mm-hmm.
After another hour of walking, you're able to travel 50% of the remaining distance to the store.
Right.
If this pattern continued, how long would it take you to walk to the grocery store?
Okay, 8 miles, you said?
8 miles from the store.
8 miles. So after an hour,
you travel 50% of the way.
2 hours, 3 hours.
another hour, the remaining 50% of the way.
Right.
If that pattern kept continuing.
And each hour you go 50% of the way, 16 hours.
How about you, Joe?
Don't have a clue.
Well, the correct answer is never. If you keep cutting the distance by half, you would never make it.
Oh, that's, yeah, because each little bitty tiny increment, you only get halfway there, right?
That's right.
All right. They're going to throw us off the radio here.
Oh, you buggers, you. Right?
Joe's kicking us off. We got to take a break here on Holy Family Radio, AM 720.
Welcome back to Money in Mission here on Holy Family Radio, AM 720, WHYF. I think I said that backwards.
That's fine.
That's fine. It works. Yeah. So, you know, we took out our last segment, remembering the weekly puzzle we did last week, and we really, really want to get to this week's weekly puzzle. I thought this was such a cool little puzzle, and I'm really looking forward to you, our listeners, sending in your answers to this weekly puzzle. So here it goes. If it takes a chicken and a half, a day and a half, to lay an egg and a half, then how many eggs will seven chickens lay in 6 days? Joe's throwing his hands up in the air. He's like, I don't know. This is a bad question. Maybe it is a bad question. I don't know. But if it takes a chicken and a half, a day and a half, to lay an egg and a half, how many eggs will seven chickens lay in 6 days?
Good luck, listeners.
Yeah, good luck to that. Send your responses to radiopuzzle@wealthdevelopmentcouncil.com, and we will read the correct answer to the puzzle on next week's show if we can agree on what the answer actually is.
Is that foreshadowing?
That's foreshadowing. That's right. That's right. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's so good to be back.
That's right. And remember, we were talking about mutual funds and how mutual funds are a tool.
We were. Yes, that's mm-hmm. right. And we got off track with the weekly puzzle. That's right. We should probably note, you know, mutual funds that get all these things potentially, you know, things you can get done using a mutual fund, and it's never fair to talk about that without saying, you know, does it cost something to be invested in a mutual fund? Mm-hmm. And it actually does. The mutual fund company has to pay for the investment manager. They have to turn on the lights. Maybe they have marketing material. They certainly have legal fees and so on and so forth. So there are costs internally in that mutual fund. And depending on the type of mutual fund, if you get involved in a mutual fund through a salesperson, then there could be an upfront sales charge, or sometimes there is a surrender charge involved as well. But then there are also
like that built in the cost of making that pizza for you.
That's right.
Like in the analogy.
That's
or
right.
Or if you wanted to do all the research on your own and mm-hmm. search out your own stocks and bonds and build your own portfolio. But what you're saying is that these mutual funds, because all of that is done for you,
that's
there's
right.
a tiny expense built into that.
There's an expense built into that. Mm-hmm. That's right. And we'll talk more about where to find that information as we go through the rest of the show today. Then there are no-load funds that don't charge you to get involved and they don't charge you to leave, but they still do have that expense involved to pay for their costs.
Right. In the same way that you should understand how tools in your toolbox work, it's a good idea to understand how mutual funds are structured as well.
That's right. And we hope the tool analogy is a good one because, again, you know, when you do different projects, you want to understand the tools that you're working with and how they work and how they can help you get that project accomplish. So,
just like a carpenter, every tool in his belt, he knows what he needs those
for. He knows what he needs it for. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. And if you own mutual funds in a portfolio, you should have an understanding. Not that you really need to like go teach a class on it, but you should have an understanding of what that mutual fund does. So we'll talk a little bit here. Let's take some time to talk about structure. And when we say structure here, what we're talking about is looking inside a mutual fund to see what the mutual fund owns. And the reason that's important is that, again, all investments involve risk, and typically investments will fluctuate up and down in value. And if the investments that the mutual fund owns fluctuate up and down in value, then the shares of your mutual fund will also fluctuate up and down.
Correct.
Right? That's so you can see how that works. So, you know, I brought along a few examples with me. We're not going to read names of mutual funds here on the air, but we'll reference, you know, again, some different portfolios. I'm looking at a mutual fund here that has 81 different stocks in it.
Mm-hmm.
81.
I see that.
Yeah. And when we look down through this, what we can see is the name of the stock, and we can see how much, what percentage does that stock represent in that mutual fund's portfolio. So here the first stock that they own, that this mutual fund owns, represents 14% of the mutual fund.
Wow.
Right?
Out of
14%.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because we do know that when we own a mutual fund, we get diversification, right? But what do you do if your mutual fund?
We look at those top five holdings.
Top five, yeah. 14% in the first one, 10% in the second one, 8.5% in the third one, almost 8% in the fourth one. I mean, half of that mutual fund is invested in five stocks.
Out of 81 total.
Out
holdings.
Of 81.
Wow.
Yeah. So really,
how diversified is that?
Well, yeah, possibly not very, right? And you know, because what will happen now is if those five stocks do really, really well, then the mutual fund was probably going to do really, really well. If those five stocks are not doing so well, then because they're concentrated, right, or there's so much invested just in those few stocks, then that'll have a dampening effect on the performance of that portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you'll look at that mutual fund some years probably and say, wow, what a great fund. And other years you'll wish you didn't own it. But it's helpful to understand why. So here's another mutual fund that I'm looking at. And this one also has 81 different stocks in it. But you can see the percentages.
Looks much less concentrated.
That's right. Yeah, the first one only has 4% invested in it. The second stock has not quite 4%. So there are smaller positions, smaller investments in each one of those stocks. And so clearly that mutual fund is going to act differently than the first one that we talked about, right?
Right.
Here's a mutual fund that has 58, we would say 58 stocks, but the very first thing on the list is, I'm not going to read the name of the investment, but it is a repurchase agreement, which is not a stock at all.
Interesting.
Right? It's just an agreement. A repurchase agreement is mm-hmm. where it's an agreement, a contractual agreement between two parties where one party agrees to sell an investment vehicle to the other party, and then they agree to buy it back later. And so they have this repurchase agreement. But almost 10% of this mutual fund is invested in a repurchase agreement.
Mm.
And so, you know, if you thought, wow, I've got a mutual fund, I own stocks and bonds in my mutual fund, and all of a sudden here's a mutual fund that has repurchase agreements in it. You really, again, you really want to know.
You might not even know what you're diversified into.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Sometimes, you know, when we talk with folks and we say, hey, here's what's inside of your mutual funds, There's a big aha moment, a look of surprise, right? Because I didn't know that my mutual fund was invested in repurchase agreements or Some mutual funds are even invested in options and warrants and futures and so on.
So in some cases, we're not even sure what holdings that we're invested in inside of these funds. So how are we able to ensure that the holdings inside of a mutual fund may align with our values?
Yeah, that's a great question. And
because that would even be harder to figure out.
That would be even harder to figure out. Yeah, that's where the, you know, remember we said that the management team in that mutual fund has a business plan, right? They lay out the objectives that they're trying to accomplish, and then they also provide a description of how they plan to go about pursuing that game plan, right? Well, they write that into something called a prospectus, right? And we'll talk about a prospectus in a second. I guess the last thing I wanted to highlight here is that, yes, all these different holdings are in these in mutual funds. And, you know, you would think that if you own a mutual fund, that the company, the mutual fund company, would have some obligation to send you a report of what they own. And they do.
You mean what's in that bucket?
What's
correct?
In that bucket. Mm-hmm. That's right. So Wildlife of Texas Mutual Fund, you know, let's pretend I own that mutual fund. Do I get any kind of report from those people saying what it is exactly that they own? Right, because by definition, I own it too. If I own the mutual fund,
and a lot of those companies may not align with Catholic values.
That's
right. Investments and companies involved in activities deemed morally objectionable.
That's exactly right. So your mutual fund, a mutual fund, is required to send you a report twice a year.
That's right.
Of what's inside the fund, but they send those reports out at the end of a particular quarter, or they have to report as of the end of a particular quarter, and then they have 60 days from there to get the report out to you.
Wait, that can be almost 5 months.
It can be almost 5 months from the beginning of a particular calendar quarter.
Wow.
So it's important, and the question, you know, we're kind of working at, how do you know what's inside the fund that you own, and is it a good tool for the project that you have in mind and the expectations that you
There's
have
There's ways
for
to
that.
Screen these, right?
There are ways to screen. Mm-hmm. That's right. And as we get to the end of our fourth segment today, we'll share a resource with you that you can look up to just see what's inside of a mutual fund that you might own yourself. But this whole thing of a prospectus, well, let's back up a bit before we get to the prospectus. When a mutual fund sends out a report saying here's what the fund owns, typically that is called like an annual report. And if you own a mutual fund, maybe you get little books from the mutual fund company, and a lot of people get those little books. And
I think those companies have a rainforest somewhere where they cut down all the trees, because they do send out lots of paperwork.
That's right. But the important thing is that those little books tell you what's going on inside of your mutual fund, right? And even if you don't understand what the book is saying, still, it comes out to you every so often, and you get an opportunity to read about what's happening there. And that's one way that you can determine if this mutual fund is in alignment with your values, and if it's also a good tool for helping you get where you want to go financially.
Absolutely.
Right.
Again, just like how money is a tool, mutual funds can also be used as a tool.
That's exactly right.
Well, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about mutual funds and prospectus. You are listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720.
Welcome back to Money in Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where we are talking about wealth management and investment planning built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. I'm James.
And I am Eric.
And we are talking about mutual funds.
That's right. And remember, they are a tool. It involves putting your money to work. And whenever you put your money to work, there's an impact, right?
That's right.
So it is important to know how your financial tools work, just like the tools we talked about earlier in the show.
That's right. We kind of beat that to death, too, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we will once or twice more before the show's over. But
that's right.
But, James, I'm sure that most people don't rate reading manual, find brochures, and literature high on the list of interesting things to do, do they?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, often, you know, the little books come
part
out.
Part of our job, but.
That's right. Yeah. It is part of our job. So, but no, the little books come out from the mutual fund company and you go, oh my goodness, what in the world is this saying? But it's a tool still. And so it's a lot of work sometimes to keep track of things, but it's important to do. So, you know, we said earlier that when you own a mutual fund, that money goes into that fund and then there's a management team that takes that money and invests it into a portfolio described in a prospectus. Really, a prospectus does several things for you, and it doesn't matter what prospectus you're looking at. They all have similar components.
So it's not like the wild, wild west going over there in terms of that mutual fund.
That's right.
It's like a guideline for it.
That's right. So it has to tell you what the investment objective is of the fund. It has to tell you what the fees and expenses are, and it has to tell you what some of the investment strategies are that they use. And a number of these things, it has to report on the managers who actually run the fund and where they went to school and what their history is in the business and their track record and so on and so forth. So there's several things like that that are really important to look at on any mutual fund that you might invest in. So we'll give you a couple of examples. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and it's important for that information to be accurate, right?
That's right.
Because that's not just a piece of marketing material. That's actually a legal document that has to be filed with the SEC.
It's a legal agreement, that's right, between the mutual fund company and its shareholders.
Right.
That's exactly right. But when you look in a prospectus, you might see things like, this fund seeks long-term growth of principal and income. So
sounds good. What does that mean?
Well, that means that they're going to invest in some financial vehicles that they hope will grow.
Right.
And other financial vehicles that they hope will maybe pay interest or dividends, and that could turn into possibly income if you own that particular fund. And so in the fund that I'm looking at right now, where I just read that objective, then under the strategies section, it says that the fund will primarily invest in a portfolio of stocks and possibly some preferred stocks or bonds. And that's where you start having those financial vehicles that could possibly produce income. And so looking down through, mutual funds are often issued in groups. So like the same company that issues a mutual fund will maybe issue several. And then that's called a family of mutual funds. And those families of mutual funds have different objectives, different goals. Some of them have the same goals, like this one still has a goal of long-term growth of principal and income. But then it goes on to say that it will buy stocks issued by companies from at least three different countries.
Oh.
Right? So... Now, if the fund would say that they're investing in at least three different countries outside of the U.S., then that would be an international or a global type of fund. So the strategy that's listed, these are financial criteria.
And they're not specifically saying which holding they will pick. This is just the criteria for the selection of holdings that they may choose to pick.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But, you know, if you're reading a prospectus, if you're reading a game plan like that and you think, oh, my goodness, you know, how do I know that that really is going to reflect, again, my values?
Right.
I mean, I may think it's going to get me where I want to go financially, but is it a reflection of my values? Well, when you're reading a prospectus, you would be able to find that information in the prospectus itself. So let's see if we can find an example.
So there's a lot of information in there, isn't there?
Oh, there's an enormous amount. Yeah, I just printed a couple of pages from this one prospectus, but there was actually 180 pages in the whole prospectus.
And I know they're required to give that out, so it is essential for you know, newer investors, but really there's even seasoned investors should also review them regularly.
That's right.
Fund strategies and holdings can change over time, so it's important to stay updated.
That's exactly right. Now, if there is a strategy change, then the the mutual fund company is required to send out a letter to all of its shareholders telling them how the strategy is changing. Mm-hmm. Because again, remember, this is an agreement with the shareholders. So they, again, we said it can't be the wild, wild west. They can't just do whatever they want to, or at least they shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a fund that says that this fund seeks high and stable current income.
High and stable current income.
Yeah. So that's very different from long-term growth,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a fund that is trying to produce income. Now, distributions probably to the people that own the fund.
Right.
And, you know, someone who is in their retirement years might be looking at funds like that as and hoping that that would be part of their income.
A way to supplement maybe if Social Security isn't enough.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, you know, the fund part, every prospectus is supposed to include a whole section about the risks of investing.
Yeah, don't skip the risk section. It often reveals unique risks specific to the fund's investment strategy.
That's right.
Such as exposure to emerging markets, complex financial instruments.
That's right. And how about to be announced transaction risk?
Okay.
Where we haven't thought what the risk is yet, but we're sure it's there.
We're on standby for it.
That's right. Stay tuned, right? So you know, again, you want it. We live in a world of risk, and risk means that you could lose money. So it's important to keep that in mind when you buy mutual funds or manage a mutual fund portfolio. So here's an interesting I'm just paging through a few of the notes that I brought with me. And, you know, we're talking about looking at principal investment strategies. So here's a fund then that says the investment objective of this fund is to seek long-term capital appreciation. That sounds financial criteria like anything else. But when you read a little further on down through, it says under normal market conditions, at least 80% of the fund's assets will be invested in companies meeting the fund's religious criteria. And this process is designed to avoid investments in companies that are believed to offer products or services that engage in practices contrary to the core values and teachings of the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh.
Right? So it is possible to have an investment vehicle that not just helps you achieve financial objectives, but also reflects your values.
That's
in that
right.
way. And, you know, we've said before, when money goes out, wherever money goes, it has an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And collectively, as investors, when we participate together in a bucket that we call a mutual fund, the more money that's in that bucket, frankly, the more of a voice those mutual fund company managers have with the companies they're invested in,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's say there is a particularly objectionable.
So they can write them letters, they have voting rights, they have ways that they can influence
That's right.
those companies.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, someone asked, you know, does that make it a better investment? Well, you know, again, you have to evaluate each investment based on the track record of the investment, how it's performed, as well as whether or not it's a reflection of your values,
mm-hmm.
right? So all investments involve risk, including the possibility of losing money. So it's, you know, we wanted to highlight that because, again, when you read these prospectuses, you'll find and you'll encounter, you know, really interesting criteria. And this is how you know whether or not the investment company that you're working with, again, is in alignment.
And there's other reports, too, that we can reference more in trying to learn more about companies, correct? Like annual reports, semi-annual reports?
Right, yeah. So an annual report and a semi-annual report, usually the fund manager or someone very high up in management in running the portfolio will write a letter to shareholders. And in the letter to shareholders, they'll talk about their outlook on the economy,
mm-hmm.
maybe what some of the success stories were in the portfolio. They'll also talk about some of the things that didn't work so well. And then accompanying that letter.
And that's kind of a look behind the curtain, right? Some of management's discussions about, like you said, where they think the market trends and investments decisions are headed.
That's exactly right.
But then qualitative information, that can be just as important as the numbers. Correct?
It can. That's right. To mm-hmm. understand the story behind the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. And it's so important, again, not just to know what we have, but why we have it and how it's working for us overall. And then accompanying that, of course, is that list of holdings. So then, you know, that's where people read through and they go, oh, well. but again, you know, the list of holdings is what helps you to see the real boots on the ground working out of that business plan for you as well. So again, you know, a mutual fund is a tool.
That's right.
And it does involve you putting your money to work. And whenever you put your money to work, then there's an impact somewhere. So as we...
we'll share a little bit about the tool to help screen the holdings in a portfolio to see if they align with their values.
Yeah, we are just about out of time here. But if you can go to a website. The website is www.evaluator.com. So now, when you go there, you remember that evaluator is spelled EVALUEATOR.
Right. I get the squiggly underneath it when I go to send it in emails.
That's
so
right.
EVALUEATOR.
That's right. EVALUEATOR.com. So www.evaluator.com. And what you can do there is you can set up an account for yourself. And, you know, we don't get paid anything. We're not selling that account. It's just a great resource that when you type in a mutual fund that you own, it will give you a report and show you whether there are any values violations in that particular mutual fund.
And the saying we like is that it helps bridge the gap between your values and the value in your portfolio.
That's right. Now, I think, you know, they give you like 5 free reports, and after that, then you have to pay. But we are out of time for this segment. We hope that today's conversation helped you better understand mutual funds.
Yes, and thank you for joining us.
That's right. You're listening to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720.